two of the stemless wine glasses she'd brought from California. "Let's start with the kitchen since we're already here. Can I offer you a glass of wine? I have red and white."
"Wine would be great. I'll have whatever you're having."
She uncorked a bottle of Pinot Noir and poured two glasses. She handed him a glass and held hers out to him. "Cheers." He clinked her glass.
"Here's to surviving Hurricane Lorraine."
He took a gulp of wine and set his glass on the counter.
"Tell me what you're thinking in terms of a renovation. This kitchen could certainly use a makeover."
"I'm thinking of adding on. You can see for yourself how tiny the space is." He circled the small kitchen as he explored the space. He paced back and forth several times in the butler's pantry, peeked inside Maddie's closet, and stood in front of the back door for several long minutes, staring through the glass panes.
"If you go out the back here, 20 feet, you'd have plenty of room for a nice workspace and an eating area. You could incorporate the butler's pantry if you wanted, but you'd have plenty of room in the new addition without it. Personally, I find butler's pantries charming."
"Why on earth would I want to keep the butler's pantry? That space is awkward and serves no purpose except housing china, crystal, and glassware I never plan to use."
"Holding on to generations of Pringle family heirlooms, silver, china, and crystal may not be of interest to you, but I can promise you, you'll miss the storage space if you take it out, especially if you like to entertain. Most of my clients convert a portion of their butler's pantry to a wet bar of some sort. If you decide to keep it, I would update the cabinetry and create a pouring station with a sink and ice maker or wine cooler or both."
"Hmm." Ellie tilted her head to the side as she considered his suggestion. "On the other hand, if I tore out the butler's pantry, I could put the wet bar over there." She waved her arm at the far corner of the room.
"That works too. The point is, you have plenty of options to modernize this space."
"Do you think it would be possible to have a banquette table and bench seats built into a wall of windows in the new area?" Julian reached for the pen and notepad on the counter, the one she used to make out her grocery lists. The pen flew across the pad as he drew. He spun the notepad around and slid it across the counter to her.
"You mean something like this?"
She picked up the notepad and studied the elevation he'd drawn. "You're very talented, Julian, as an architect and an artist. This is exactly what I had in mind."
"That's a popular configuration these days. My clients like to bring the outdoors inside as much as possible."
Wine glass in hand, he walked up and down the back hallway between the kitchen and her studio.
"You'll want to reconfigure this area in here. What do you call that room, by the way?"
He swept his hand in the direction of her studio.
I hope you don't mind. I stuck my head in there while you were upstairs. Guessing those furnishings are yours, since they look nothing like the rest of the house."
Ellie smiled. "That's my stuff from California. For now, I'm using it as my studio. I haven't decided what purpose it will serve going forward."
"So you are an artist." I noticed the easels.
Ellie felt her face flush. "I hope you didn't look too closely at the paintings on the easels. One is an image I need to get out of my head, and the other I just started." He offered her a warm smile.
"I'm sure your work is wonderful, Ellie, but I didn't go in. I didn't want to drip water all over your sisal rug."
She wasn't embarrassed about her work. She just wasn't ready to share the magnolia watercolor yet. The painting elicited such strong emotions for her. At a glance, it was nothing more than a simple painting of a magnolia tree, and not a very good one. The observer had to look closely to see the little girl with her baby doll hiding behind the thick branches. She followed Julian back to the butler's pantry.
This was the exterior wall in the original house, he said as he inspected the thickness of the dining room door jamb. Whoever added the kitchen did a crappy job.
I'm not following you. Where was the original kitchen?
In a separate building out behind the house. Prior to the Civil War, slaves cooked all the meals for the homeowner and his family over an open fireplace. Outhouses were built to keep the cooking smells and heat away from the main house. Most of these homes had a whole village of outhouses. In addition to the kitchen, they had a washhouse and a carriage house that would have served as a livery and the slaves' quarters, not to mention sheds to house the garden and equipment. Many of these kitchens and carriage houses were destroyed in the great earthquake of 1886. Of those that still exist, some have been attached to the main houses, while others have been converted into small homes. As he spoke, his amber eyes were alive with excitement over what was undoubtedly his life's passion. That's fascinating, Julian. You are a real expert. I have so much to learn about this area.
I'm glad to hear your enthusiasm. So many folks today deem our cultural heritage as politically incorrect.
Ellie wrinkled her brow. I don't understand. We can't change history. Why not learn from the mistakes our forefathers made?
I agree with you, he said, his face serious. If only everyone felt that way.
She knocked on the dining room wall. So, if this was the exterior wall, where would the back door have been?
Where the laundry room is now. Having a center hallway with doors on either end helped circulate the air back before the invention of air conditioning.
I can almost smell the salty air flowing through the hallway off the harbor on a cool day.
Ellie closed her eyes and imagined herself descending the staircase in a hoop skirt, while Julian, dressed in his three-piece suit, waited at the door to take her for a carriage ride.
Getting ahead of ourselves now, aren't we, Ellie?
She opened her eyes again and shook off her daydream. Ellie refilled their wine glasses, and they toured the rest of the downstairs, stopping at each room in turn, starting with the dining room and working their way clockwise. She saw the house in a whole new light through Julian's eyes. He pointed out things she either hadn't noticed or hadn't known, like the Waterford chandelier in the dining room, the rows of crown molding, and the intricate carvings on the mantelpieces. He referred to the living room as the drawing room, and the porches as piazzas. He was impressed by what he thought was cypress paneling in the library and suggested ways to lighten up the room by using neutral tones and putting an animal print rug on the floor.
You sound like a decorator instead of an architect, Ellie teased. He laughed. It's a fine line sometimes. My clients get so used to me making decisions for them, oftentimes they don't know when to stop. I saw what you did with your studio. You have great taste, Ellie. You should clear out all of Count Dracula's stuff and breathe fresh life into the other rooms.
How would I go about doing that? I put my bedroom furniture in the attic. Everything else from my tiny apartment in San Francisco is in my studio. If I donated all my grandmother's things to Goodwill, I'd have to start over with nothing.
Would that be such a bad thing? But I wouldn't donate it to Goodwill. Not until you learn the value of your grandmother's possessions. I have a friend who owns an antique store on King Street. I'll get him over here after the storm. He'll make you an offer on anything he's interested in and make suggestions on how to get rid of the rest. If you're looking for a designer, I've worked on a couple of projects with Jackie Hart of JSH Designs. She's good at blending the old with the new. I'd be happy to introduce you.
I'd like that. Ellie nodded her head with enthusiasm. Her luck was changing. In the course of a stormy afternoon, not only had she made two new friends, she'd located a realtor, an architect, an antiques dealer, and a decorator. Maybe she would survive in Charleston after all. He asked to see the master bedroom and bolted up the stairs before she could stop him. "Wait, where are you going?" She rushed to catch up with him, with the dogs scrambling after her. At the top of the stairs, he turned right and barged into her grandmother's room. "You're wasting your time in here, Julian. It's just more of the same gloominess." She propped herself against the door to prevent it from closing on him. The dogs stood on the threshold with their fur raised in lines down their backs. Julian circled the room and opened the door to the bathroom. "This is one of the biggest nesters I've seen in a house from this era. Are you sleeping in here?" She shook her head. "Not while my grandmother's spirit is still here." "Now, Ellie." He cocked his head to the side, reminding her of a fishwife with his hairy arms and legs sticking out from her pink bathrobe. "Are you saying you believe in ghosts?" A week ago, before some otherworldly force had locked her in this room, she would have thought the idea preposterous. "Look at them," she pointed at Mills and Pixie, their fur still standing to attention. Mills let out a little woof. "See, your dog just growled at the room." "That wasn't a growl, that was a woof." He looked down at the dogs and then up at her. "Does your grandmother's spirit have anything to do with why you're standing sentry in front of the door?" "You can make fun of me all you want, but on my first day here, I got locked in this room." She gripped the doorknob. "Even though there's no locking mechanism on this knob. Every time I open this door, I come back 5 minutes later to find it closed." His smile grew wider, his smirk more annoying as she continued to talk. "According to my housekeeper, the Gullah people believe a spirit can't rest until it passes into the afterworld. Maddie worked for my grandmother for 40 years. She knew her better than anyone. She says my grandmother needs to know it's okay for her to pass over or whatever it is spirits do, and that keeping the door open will help her realize that." With a flippant shrug, he said, "Then why not just take the door off its hinges?" "I can't do that." She shivered and drew her hoodie tighter around her. "If you remove the door, my grandmother's spirit will be free to roam the house."
"Isn't that what you want?"
"I want her spirit out of the house, not roaming around inside, floating over me while I'm sleeping." She realized how ridiculous she sounded. Besides, she'd do just about anything to get rid of her grandmother's spirit. "How hard is it to remove the door?"
"It will take less than a minute if you'll get me a flathead screwdriver and a hammer."
Ellie didn't budge. "Maybe we should wait until after the storm. Her spirit might not be able to exit the house with the hurricane shutters closed." His arm shot out with his pointer finger aimed at the stairs.
"Go."
She hung her head and did as she was told. When she returned, Julian was squatting down, talking to the dogs in a soothing voice and stroking their fur. Mills and Pixie relaxed and plopped down with their bellies flat against the floor. They watched with their muzzles resting on their front paws as Julian hammered the pins out of the hinges and removed the heavy door from its frame. He wrestled the door to the empty bedroom across the hall and returned to admire his handiwork. "Tell me the truth, Julian," she said as they stood looking into her grandmother's bedroom. "You've lived in Charleston all your life. Do you not believe in ghosts?"
"I've experienced some strange phenomena in my day. Most of the houses in historic downtown date back to before the Civil War. We're talking generations of interest in characters and domineering figures, many from the same families, living and dying in these homes, it stands to reason that some of their spirits may linger. I'd be willing to bet that none of those domineering figures ruled a household like my grandmother. And now, you've set her spirit free to come after me in my sleep.
Chapter 14. Ellie.
While they waited for his clothes to finish drying, Julian and Ellie nibbled on pate and watched the coverage of the storm on the local news channel. The circular mob of green and yellow was rotating on the radar in a definitive path toward the South Carolina coast. Julian explained that the worst of the storm would hit at low tide around midnight,
which means the flooding won't be too bad.
Knowledgeable on a variety of subjects, Julian was more worldly than Jake. She'd learned everything there was to know about her former lover during their first month together. Except, of course, that he was married with children living in the next state up. When the dryer buzzer sounded, he drained the last of the wine from his glass.
That's my signal to leave.
So soon? I have all this food. I was hoping you'd stay for dinner. If you don't like the color, she tugged on the sleeve of her robe, I have a floral one upstairs you can wear instead. He wrapped his arms around himself.
I like this one, thank you very much. It's cozy and warm. I'm a real man. I can wear pink.
He stared down at Mills.
I'd love to stay for dinner, but I really need to feed this one before he starts gnawing at the pedestals on your dining room table.
Ellie scratched the golden retriever between his ears. Pixie would be happy to share some of her food with her new friend.
You mean kibble for pipsqueaks? He'd eat the whole bag in one go.
He left the room and returned a few minutes later, fully dressed.
I need to check on my house anyway.
Of course you do. She walked with him down the hall to the front door. As he was putting on his raincoat, she risked a glance toward the stairs, expecting to see her grandmother's ghost floating toward her. Julian pinched her chin.
Don't worry, pretty lady. There's no such thing as ghosts.
He pulled his hood over his head and took off down the sidewalk with Mills at his side. Ellie closed and locked the door. She looked down at her dog, who stared back at her with the saddest eyes she'd ever seen.
I know, little girl. I wanted them to stay, too.
She picked her dog up and held her close. After we eat dinner, we'll find a way to entertain ourselves. Without Wi-Fi, her choices were limited. She couldn't watch Netflix on her iPad or download a book to her Kindle app. Maddie brought in plenty of wood. Maybe we'll build a fire in the library. It can't be that hard, right? We can always Google best practices for lighting a fire. Her shoulders slumped.
Or not. We'll just have to wing it on our own.
Ellie placed her casserole in the oven, preferring a slow reheat to the microwave. She was scooping penne with vodka sauce onto a plate 45 minutes later when someone pounded on the front door. Who in the world is out in this weather? She thought as she hurried to the door. She was surprised to see Julian on her front porch, dressed like a sailor, in head-to-toe yellow foul weather gear. Mills shivered beside him, and torrents of rain blew sideways behind them. When a gray, yard-sized trash can bounced down the street, she grabbed him by the arm. "Get in here," she said and yanked him inside. She closed the door against the stormy night. "What are you doing here?"
"You forgot to give me your number."
His face scrunched up in confusion, and he added,
"For the antique dealer."
"I'm pretty sure that could have waited, Julian." She planted her fists on her hips, pretending to be cross, but secretly she was pleased, not only because she wanted to be with him, but
because she didn't want to be alone in the house during a hurricane with her grandmother's spirit on the loose.
I brought a change of clothes with me,
he said, holding up a black trash bag.
Although, I think my sailor suit kept these dry.
He slipped off his coat and stepped out of his bibs. He felt his plaid cotton shirt and jeans.
Yep, all dry.
He removed a towel from the bag, draped it across his dog, and then stuck his hand in the bag once again.
For you.
He handed her a bottle of liquor.
Consider it a housewarming gift.
She read the label on the cognac bottle.
I'm impressed. You brought the good stuff.
He dropped his bag on the floor beside the door.
We're having a hurricane party. The situation calls for the best.
I applaud your enthusiasm. She set the cognac bottle on the Church of England altar. I was just getting dinner ready. Are you hungry?
He patted his belly. Starving.
In that case, do you mind starting a fire in the library while I fix our plates? He rubbed his hands together like a little boy on his first camping trip with his father.
I'm on it.
45 minutes later, Julian and Ellie abandoned their empty plates on the coffee table beside them and sank deep into the velvet cushions at opposite ends of the sofa. The dogs napped on the floor in front of the crackling fire while the wind howled outside the shuttered windows.
You realize I'm going to have to spend the night, Julian said.
She cut her eyes at him without moving her head. You can sleep in my grandmother's bed.
No, thanks. He closed his eyes and placed his folded hands in his lap. I'm plenty comfortable right here.
They lounged in a food coma until Pixie stirred 20 minutes later. She stretched her front legs and wandered over to Ellie, sniffing at her right hand that was dangling off the side of the sofa. Julian cracked an eyelid at Pixie.
Bigger dogs have bigger bladders. You should consider that the next time you shop for a pet.
Ellie swung her legs over the side of the sofa and sat up. I can put paper down in the kitchen for Pixie. That won't work for your large dog.
It would work, but Mills hasn't better manners than that.
Julian rolled off the sofa.
Let's open the front door for them and see what they do.
As it turned out, Pixie followed Mills's lead. They ran to the edge of the porch, squatted to do their business, and scampered back inside to the library, resuming their positions in front of the fire. Julian took their dirty plates to the kitchen while Ellie went upstairs for bedding. She gathered all the duvets, blankets, and pillows she could carry. She had no intention of sleeping upstairs alone with her grandmother's spirit floating around and the hurricane wailing like a banshee outside. They sipped cognac and talked well into the night. Julian confided in Ellie about his ex-wife who had come home from her nursing job at MUSC 3 years ago and announced she was taking their daughter and moving to Spartanburg, about as far away as she could get from Charleston but still be in the same state of South Carolina in order to abide by custody laws.
She totally blindsided me, he said. I thought everything was fine in our marriage. I was happy. I assumed she was as well. She said she no longer loved me, and she needed to change. I wish she'd at least given our marriage a chance, but she refused to consider seeing a marriage counselor. Weekends, twice a month, with a 7-year-old isn't enough. At least not for me. We used to be close. Now our relationship feels strained. I sense her mother may be feeding Katie some unflattering lies about me.
He reached for the bottle on the coffee table and poured each of them another finger of cognac.
It's your turn to share. Tell me your deepest, darkest secret.
If only I could remember it. She spoke of her memory loss and her mother's diaries. Something bad happened to me in this house when I was a child. I know it. Like I know my name is Ellie Pringle. I have a strong hunch there are more of my mother's diaries somewhere in this house that will provide the answers I'm looking for.
And you have no idea what that something might have been? I'm a good listener, if you want to talk about it.
Ellie smiled at him. I sense that about you, actually. Her expression turned serious. I'll tell you about it sometime, but not tonight. I'd hate to ruin a perfectly good hurricane party.
Tipsy from the cognac, they snuggled together under a mound of blankets, with him spooning her from behind. When she opened her eyes 6 hours later, Julian and the dogs were gone. She heard the soft murmur of voices on Bennett's portable TV from down the hall and smelled the faint aroma of coffee brewing. She folded the bed covers into a neat pile on the sofa. She was headed toward the kitchen when Julian appeared in the doorway.
Coffee?
He held out a steaming mug.
I took the liberty of adding cream and sugar. You seem like a super sweet girl to me.
She took the mug from him.
That's bad, Julian, she said in response to his cheesy remark.
I guess I'm a little rusty. I haven't tried to pick up a girl since my college days.
She would let him pick her up any day, corny lines and all. The dogs, reeking of wet fur, appeared at his side. I take it they've been out?
I had to drag them. Pipsqueak was too afraid to venture into the yard. This time she pooped on the porch. Lucky for you, her turd was so lightweight the wind blew it away.
Ellie rolled her eyes at him. I can't believe we haven't lost power yet.
Shh, he said, bringing his fingers to his lips. Don't say it. Most of Charleston is without.
Are the streets flooded? She asked.
Not too bad.
He stepped out of her way and gestured toward the front door.
See for yourself.
They were nearing the door when the sound of dripping water coming from somewhere upstairs stopped her in her tracks. Do you hear that? He narrowed his eyes and listened.
That's not good.
He handed her his mug, yanked the door open, and ran barefoot out into the yard. She stood in the doorway, holding both coffee mugs, watching him. He leaned into the wind as he shielded his eyes and stared up at the house. She noticed a small river flowing down South Battery Street behind him.
The tarp has blown back,
he called to her, his voice barely audible over the roar of the wind.
Get every bucket you can find and meet me in the attic.
He darted back into the house and up the stairs. Ellie deposited the coffee mugs on the Church of England altar on her way to the laundry. She searched all the cabinets and closets in there and in the kitchen. The cooler Bennett had dropped off and the two Maddie had brought in from the garage were the only suitable containers she could find for water collecting. She dragged them up the stairs to the attic. The rain was pouring in through leaks in the roof, and then seeping through the ceiling in her grandmother's bedroom. For the next hour and a half, they ran up and down the stairs, emptying and repositioning the buckets until the flow was finally under control. Exhausted, she collapsed on a nearby steamer trunk.
I blame this on you, Julian. You unleashed my grandmother's spirit on us by removing her door.
He need her to move over so as to make room for him on the trunk.
Are you suggesting your grandmother is responsible for the top blowing off?
Feeling herself near tears, she propped her elbows on her knees and buried her face in her hands.
I know it sounds twisted. I didn't believe in ghosts until I came here. Why'd my grandmother have to drag me into it? She should have donated this money pit to the Charleston Historical Society and called it a day.
He nudged her with his shoulder.
Are we feeling sorry for ourselves?
You're damn right I'm feeling sorry for myself. She swiped at her eyes with the back of her hand. Eleanor Pringle totally disrupted my life. I moved all the way across the country to live in a house that's falling down around me and haunted by ghosts. I'm creeped out by all her possessions, and I've become obsessed with remembering my past when I'm clearly better off not knowing what happened to me here.
Look. He rubbed circles on her back between her shoulder blades. You've just made a drastic change in your life. It's only natural for you to feel overwhelmed. Give yourself some time to adjust. I agree, there is an enormous amount of work that needs to be done to this house, but I can help you with all that.
She sniffled.
Would you?
He pulled her close to him.
Of course I will. You are a super sweet girl.
He kissed her on the side of the head.
You need a friend, and I enjoy your company. I'm even growing attached to Pipsqueak. But don't tell anyone I admitted that.
Tears blurred her vision as she stared down at her lap. She noticed a brass plate on the top of the steamer trunk and ran her fingers across the engraved initials. A.L.P. She leaped to her feet.
Wait a minute! What are we sitting on?
She took him by the arm and hauled him off the trunk.
An old trunk, like the one I took to camp every summer, Julian said.
Those are my mother's initials, she pointed to the brass plate. Maybe her diaries are in here.
She knelt down in front of the trunk and fidgeted with the lock. No telling where the key is. Removing a pocket knife from his pocket, he knelt down beside her.
I can pry it open, but it might ruin the lock.
The lock is the least of my concerns, she said and moved out of his way. Julian jimmied the lock open and lifted the lid. Ellie's heart sank when she saw the party dresses stuffed inside. Elaborate frocks made of taffeta, satin, and velvet. She dug through the dresses, tossing them in a heap on the attic floor beside the trunk. When she reached the bottom, she fell back on her rear end.
Nothing.
Julian tilted his head from side to side as he scrutinized the trunk from different angles.
Maybe not. It looks like the trunk might have a false bottom.
Leaning over, he reached inside and pried free the board that served as the fake bottom.
Bingo.
Ellie peered inside the trunk. Scattered across the bottom were 6 leather-bound journals.
Chapter 15. Ashton. The train ride south seemed endless. The other passengers were tucked away for the night in their berths, but I couldn't sleep for worrying over how Mother would react to my predicament. Pacing up and down the aisles did little to alleviate my anxiety, and the 6-hour delay at Union Station in Washington only added to my angst. When we finally arrived in Charleston, I took a taxi from the train station and got home just as my mother was sitting down to dinner in the dining room. She barely glanced in my direction when I entered the room.
Well now, look what the cat drug in.
It's nice to see you too, Mother. I'd learned from years of experience that the direct approach was the best approach with her. Pulling a chair up to the table beside her, I placed my hands on the table and laced my fingers together. I know how much you appreciate it when people are up front with you, so I'll come right out and tell you why I'm here. I'm pregnant, Mother. Too far along to have an abortion, not that I would even consider it if it were an option. If you'll allow me to stay here until the baby comes, I plan to put it up for adoption and return to my life in New York. I'll be out of your hair for good. Mother dropped her fork to her plate with a clatter so loud it made me tremble all over.
Her eyes bore into mine.
So, you've come running home to me with your tail between your legs and a baby in your belly. Who and where is the father?
I told her the father is no longer a part of my life, that we had a relationship, but it is over, and that is all she needs to know.
I was reassured by the strength in my voice. I'd grown a backbone during my time in New York. If you'd married James Middleton like you were meant to, we'd be planning your baby shower, not hiding in shame. And hide you will. I won't have you out on the streets for everyone in Charleston to see your womb swelling from the bastard growing inside it. If word about this gets out, it will spread like wildfire. Flaunting your half-naked body in those raunchy fashion magazines has earned you celebrity status around here. I've had to cut down on the number of social engagements I attend because your star-struck fans are constantly approaching me. One young woman had the audacity to ask me for my autograph. Most mothers would be proud of my success. Success! My mother brought her fist down on the table, rattling her plate. You've made a mess of your life and brought that mess home for me to deal with. You call that a success?
I sat up taller in my chair. In the past 3 years, I've appeared on the covers of every major New York fashion magazine. Yes, Mother. I call that a success.
I think your behavior is deplorable. You've cheapened yourself. No self-respecting man will ever marry you now.
She folded her linen napkin, placed it on her plate, and rose from the table.
If you want to remain in my house, we'll discuss in the morning the rules by which you'll live here.
But Mother had already left for church by the time I woke up the next morning. Homesick for New York, I walked north to Broad Street and west until I located a newspaper stand. I purchased a New York Times and strolled the long way back to the Battery, enjoying the fragrant spring air. My mother was waiting for me at the front door when I arrived home, her black pillbox hat still perched on her head and her handbag dangling from her arm.
I told you not to leave this house.
Holding the paper out as evidence, I explained that I'd only gone over to Broad Street for a newspaper.
When I said, don't leave this house, I meant don't walk to the end of the sidewalk. You may go out in the back garden, and that's it.
I rolled my eyes at her. Jeez, Mother. Don't you think you're overreacting?
I did not see the blow coming when she hauled off and smacked me across the face.
My hand flew to my cheek. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Maddie, the young black maid Mother had hired in my absence, peeking at us from around the doorway to the dining room.
Don't you roll your eyes at me, young lady,
Mother said, wagging her finger in my face.
You will abide by my rules while you're living in my house, or you will leave.
She grabbed my father's jogging stick from the umbrella stand in the corner of the hall and chased me to the stairs with it. My hand still pressed to my cheek, I went to my room, where I stayed for the rest of the day. Someone had stripped my room of every trace of my past life. Gone were the clothes from my closets and drawers. Gone were the ribbons and trophies I'd won showing horses and sailing in regattas. All my framed photographs of friends, including the only picture I owned of my father, had disappeared. The collection of black and white images I'd photographed and matted in my photography class in college had been taken off the walls. The white eyelet comforter and chintz skirt of lavender bouquets that had once adorned my bed had been replaced with a set of scratchy sheets and a thin cotton blanket. The only sign that my room had ever been inhabited was a flimsy cardboard box, stuffed full of toys, and tucked away at the back of my closet. When I asked Mother about my things over dinner, she told me that since I'd left town without so much as a note or a goodbye, she assumed I no longer wanted them and gave them away to the Salvation Army. Mother had always been strict.
but she's never hit me before. She changed while I was in New York. Her stare has grown colder, and her demands more rigid. Her mistrust of the world now borders on paranoia. Things have worsened in the days, weeks, and months since I got home. Mother rules over this household with dictatorial superiority. Deadbolts have appeared on the doors downstairs, and the ones leading to the second-floor piazza have been permanently sealed. The security system she had installed is controlled by a small silver key, which she wears on a red satin ribbon around her neck. She stopped going out altogether, preferring instead to watch over me like the warden on a jailhouse block. The grim reality of my new existence has set in. Life crawls by for me upstairs in my Spartan room, which has become my refuge. I bide my time by doing as I'm told and staying out of Mother's way as much as possible. I take my meals up here unless I'm summoned to the dining room for another one of Mother's many lectures. I yearn for my glamorous life in New York. I miss Louisa, and God help me, I miss Abbott something terrible. I keep the newspaper article announcing his job with Warner Brothers Studio hidden beneath my mattress as a reminder of his betrayal. Every time I look at it, seeing the photo of him with his arm around another woman brings on a torrent of fresh tears. To pass the time, I write letters to Abbott I'll never mail, and read whatever my mother brings home from the library. Non-fiction books, classics, and the occasional mystery. Romance novels are out of the question, of course. "No smut for the slut," Mother said to me one day. The fear of being hit with my father's jogging stick, now an appendage of Mother's arm, keeps the staff in line. But sympathetic to my situation, they contribute what little they dare to make my life more tolerable. Maddie brings in fresh flowers every morning. A single stem from the rose garden in a sterling bud vase, or a small bouquet of blue hydrangeas in a crystal container. And every afternoon, Sally Bell delivers my tea tray piled high with delicate sweet cakes and finger sandwiches. Abraham lugged an old chaise lounge and floor lamp down from the attic for me, and position them in the corner by the window. I read into the wee hours of the morning with the night air, fragrant with the citrusy sweet scent of magnolia blossoms, drifting through the open window. I'm allowed to keep my bedroom window open because without the aid of a ladder, I have no means of escaping. Why would I escape when I have nowhere to go? Mother refuses to let me see a doctor. She's hired a midwife instead, who she claims is capable of getting the job done. A midwife is fine by me. I like Jeanette Lane quite a lot. She's the grandmother type with gray hair, plump cheeks, and a calm manner of speaking. Jeanette scored extra brownie points with me when she asked Mother to wait out in the hall during the examination. She declared the baby's heartbeat strong and me fit as a fiddle. She gave me a bottle of prenatal vitamins and a chocolate eclair she brought from a bakery on Broad Street. Subsequent checkups followed a similar pattern until her fourth visit in June when I was 7 months along. "Your mother tells me you're considering giving the baby up for adoption. I can make the arrangements for you if you're absolutely certain this is what you want." Jeanette sat down on the edge of the mattress beside me. "You know, Ashton, no one can make you give away your baby. This is something you must decide for yourself." When I first learned I was pregnant, adoption seemed the right choice for the baby and me. But I'm not so sure anymore. I stared down at my immense body sprawled out on the bed, swollen breasts, belly the size of Mount Everest, and thighs so fleshy they rub together when I walk. I will never again fit into any of my clothes, much less appear in any fashion magazine. I placed my hand on my abdomen and felt the baby moving around. She's an active one.
"You're convinced it's a girl,"
Jeanette said. I nodded. It sounds stupid, I know. But I've grown attached to her. I feel like I already know her. She's part of me. Jeanette smiled.
The bond between a mother and her offspring is strong.
My throat ached with unshed tears. I'm honestly not sure I'll be able to give her up.
Jeanette glanced toward the door where my mother was no doubt eavesdropping on the other side.
How would your mother feel about you keeping the baby? She said, her voice a near whisper.
She'd throw a fit like you've never seen and ship me off to Siberia, which is why I don't plan on telling her until the baby comes.
Jeanette stroked my arm.
Promise me you won't let her force you into making a decision while you're having these reservations.
I promise. I drew an imaginary X across my chest, just like Louisa did when she promised not to tell anyone about my pregnancy. So far, I've managed to change the subject every time Mother mentions adoption,
but I won't be able to put her off for much longer.
Jeanette removed her stethoscope from her black medical bag and lifted my maternity blouse. The lines in her face deepened as she listened to my belly.
What's wrong?
Jeanette shook her head and lifted a finger to silence me. For several excruciatingly long minutes, she moved the round end of the stethoscope to different parts of my abdomen. Finally, she sat back and freed the earpieces from her ears.
What is it, Jeanette? You're scaring me. Nothing's wrong, dear.
She opened my file and flipped through the pages.
This explains a lot of things, actually. The weight gain and measurements. It all makes sense.
I struggled to sit up. What makes sense, Jeanette? Tell me now.
I'm hearing 2 heartbeats today.
My mouth dropped open and my eyes grew wide.
I don't understand. How can that be? I've heard of it happening before, although it's never happened to a patient of mine. It's possible for one baby to hide behind the other, sometimes all the way through until delivery.
She squeezed my knee.
I dare say your decision just got a whole lot more complicated.
The door flew open, the knob banging against the wall, and in marched Mother. Jeanette rose to face her.
Congratulations, Mrs. Pringle.
Your daughter is expecting twins.
Chapter 16. Ellie. Ellie felt herself on the verge of insanity. The power had gone out as she and Julian were coming down from the attic. Without the reassuring hum of the air conditioner, the stillness of the house tap-danced on her already frayed nerve endings. She'd barricaded her bedroom door with a chest of drawers. With the hurricane shutters blocking the windows, there was no way out. The idea was to prevent the evil spirits that tormented her from getting in. Her voice of reason warned her she was being melodramatic, but her terrified self convinced her otherwise. She'd upset her grandmother's spirit by reading her mother's diaries.
Get mad all you want, you old bat! My mother's story needs to be heard! She screamed to the empty room.
She couldn't see her hand in front of her face in the pitch black. She'd been reading for hours by the light of Bennett's lantern. Her mother's scribble made the reading slow. The light had eventually grown dim, and then went out completely. Ellie hadn't thought to bring more batteries upstairs with her when she came to bed around 8. Julian had long since gone home. Truth be told, she wasn't sure what time he'd even left. Early afternoon was her best guess. She'd barely raised her head from the diary to tell him goodbye. She would give anything to feel his capable arms around her again.
She hadn't thought to bring her cell phone upstairs with her either. A lot of good it was doing on the kitchen counter. She was desperate to call her father, to tell him about her twin, his other child. Boy or girl, who knew? What had happened to her sibling? Where was he or she now? Was the dark-haired girl from her flashbacks her sister? Was whatever happened to her twin the traumatic event that caused her to block out those years? Her stomach ached from hunger. She hadn't eaten anything since breakfast. Following Bennett's instructions, she'd kept the refrigerator and freezer doors closed to preserve her food. The coolers were needed in the attic. Although, over the course of the afternoon, the rain had slowed to a drizzle. She'd been too preoccupied with her mother's diaries to think about eating anyway. And what she'd learned in those diaries had stolen her appetite until now. Ellie succumbed to her tears. She grabbed Pixie and crawled beneath the bed. She squeezed her eyes shut and buried her face in her little dog's fur. She fell into a fitful sleep, plagued with angry voices, slamming doors, and the faint sound of a child sobbing. When she woke again, a beam of sunlight cast a warm glow on the floorboards in front of her. Crawling from beneath the bed, she saw a workman waving and offering a thumbs up from the window. She nodded her head vigorously at him. "Hell yes, I want those storm shutters open." Manhandling the dresser out of the way, she went downstairs and out into the yard. Much to her surprise, not a cloud lingered in the periwinkle sky. Floodwaters had receded from the streets, and hordes of workmen swarmed the yards up and down the block, picking up downed tree limbs and raking up debris. The crew leader for the roofing team approached her.
"I'm disappointed to see the tarp didn't hold. Was there much damage inside?"
"The master bedroom was flooded, but it's not your fault. My grandmother never should have let her house get in such disrepair." Shielding her eyes from the sun, she stared up at the men crawling on her roof. "How long before you get it fixed?"
"There's no rain in the forecast until the weekend. We'll have all the leaks repaired by then. The whole project should be completed by midweek next week."
"Just in time for me to put the house on the market." Ellie turned her back on him and went inside for her phone. When she discovered her battery had died during the night, she connected the phone to the battery pack Bennett had left for her. She popped a K-cup into her Keurig, but remembered the power was out.
"Ugh, no coffee either. This is shaping up to be a truly miserable day."
She drummed her fingertips on the counter while she waited for her phone to power up. When it came back to life 5 minutes later, she scrolled through the missed calls and texts. Two texts were from her father, but the missed calls were all from Julian. He'd left several voice messages, each growing more concerned as the night wore on. The most recent call had come in an hour ago. In his message, he asked if he could stop by around 11 that morning with the antiques dealer. She clicked on his number.
"Ellie, thank goodness," he said when he answered. "I've been worried about you."
She sank down to the step stool, propped her elbow on the counter, and braced her forehead with her palm. "By accident, I left my phone in the kitchen when I went to bed. I was too terrified to leave my room to come get it."
"Uh-oh, sounds like someone had a rough night."
"I learned some unsettling things from my mother's diaries. I'll tell you about them when I see you. 11 is fine to meet with the antique dealer. The sooner I get my grandmother's things cleared out of this house, the better."
"I hear ya,"
he said with a chuckle.
I also left a message for my builder friend about giving you an estimate to fix a ceiling in the master.
If he's available, I'll bring him along as well.
Thank you, Julian, she said, her voice a whisper. I really appreciate it. I'm sorry for going on and on about my problems. How did your house survive the storm?
This old house is built like Fort Sumter. She came through unscathed. I even have my power back.
Allie sighed.
Lucky you. The local news is reporting that most of the power in the downtown area will be restored by the end of the day.
Oh, good. A hot shower to look forward to, she said without any enthusiasm.
I'll see you at 11.
For the next hour, Ellie paced the kitchen floor, drinking orange juice in the absence of coffee, while she waited for Maddie to arrive. In all the talks they'd shared since Ellie had arrived in Charleston, the housekeeper had never once mentioned her twin. And Ellie was anxious to find out why. When there was no sign of her by 10 o'clock, she began to worry she'd gotten hurt or her house had been damaged in the storm. She went to the desk in the library, but her grandmother's address book wasn't in the top right-hand drawer where Maddie said it would be. She searched the rest of the drawers in the desk, and then all the ones in the kitchen and her grandmother's bedroom as well. I'm beginning to wonder if such an address book exists, she said to Pixie, who had been following her from room to room. I've certainly never seen it. She retrieved the coolers from upstairs and loaded them up with food from the refrigerator and freezer while she waited for Julian. He arrived with his builder friend and the antique dealer at 11:05. After a brief round of introductions, she directed the builder to the master bedroom to assess the water damage and instructed the antique dealer to show himself around. Make me an offer on anything you're interested in. Everything is up for grabs.
Everything?
Evan Luna asked, standing in front of the grandfather clock, with a look of admiration on his ruddy face.
Everything, Ellie repeated. I didn't know my grandmother. Therefore, I have no sentimental attachment to her possessions, and her style doesn't suit my tastes.
I understand where you're coming from. Gothic went out several centuries ago.
His beefy hand carefully opened the clock's door.
That's not to say she didn't own some valuable pieces like this one. I'll make a fair offer on anything I can sell in my store, and put you in touch with a collector whose tastes aren't quite as refined. He snickered. In other words, he'll haul off anything you don't want and give you a reasonable sum of money in exchange.
Ellie felt the tension leave her body. That's an offer I can't refuse, and the sooner the better. Julian went with Ellie to the kitchen.
Are you okay? You don't look so good.
She followed his gaze to the same pair of jeans and pink hoodie she'd been wearing since they got caught in the rain in the park on Monday night.
I didn't sleep well.
Once again, she reached for the Keurig and once again remembered she didn't have electricity.
I'm sorry.
Julian grabbed the back of her neck and drew her in for a hug.
I should have thought to bring you some coffee.
Tears welled in her eyes, and she wiped them with her hoodie sleeve.
Why don't we take a walk?
Julian suggested.
We can go to my house for coffee. You grab Pixie's leash, and I'll tell Hugh and Evan we're leaving. I'll meet you out front in 5.
The salty air quieted her nerves and cleared her mind. As they strolled down Church Street toward his house, she told him what she'd discovered in her mother's journals. He listened intently, and when she'd finished talking, he asked,
"And you have no recollection of this twin?"
"Only a glimpse of a girl with dark hair, who I thought might have been my playmate. Interestingly enough, when I asked Maddie about this girl on Monday, she denied knowing anything about her. She's hiding something.
I feel it in my gut. Do you think you scared her off? And that's why she didn't show up for work today? Maybe. Or maybe her house was damaged in the storm. If there is...